Greetings and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. I'm Mark Zitter, CEO of Zitter Health Insights, a market research firm, and a member of the club's Health and Medicine member-led forum. I'm also chair of tonight's program, which is entitled Living Fully, Reimagining End of Life. Each year, there are more than 2.5 million deaths in America, and close to half of those deaths occur in hospice. That's nearly triple the proportion of Americans who died in hospice as recently as 1996. The dramatic growth in hospice use represents, to my mind anyway, both a response to the over-medicalization of death in America, and I would argue a yearning to make dying something other than just a horrible ending to life. I've thought a lot about these issues myself over the past few decades. 10 years ago, I co-founded a telephone counseling service that was meant for patients with life-limiting conditions. And since that time, we've held tens of thousands of these difficult and moving conversations. I'm also married to a palliative care physician through whom I met tonight's guest. And we talk about these issues all the time at the dinner table. You can imagine we don't get invited out much. But from all these experiences, it's really become clear to me that far too often we die miserably in America. We just do. We try not to think about death. And when we do, it's usually we think about it as a medical experience. Now, nobody likes medical experiences, and yet we relegate this crucial part of our lives to that realm. That's the bad news. There is some good news. At least through my travels, I have a few times been inspired by a small number of leaders who are addressing the opportunity to make dying as meaningful as living. One of the most inspiring of these leaders that I've met is today's guest, B.J. Miller, the executive director of Zen Hospice Project in San Francisco. BJ is a hospice and palliative care specialist who treats both inpatients and outpatients with terminal or life-altering conditions at UCSF Medical Center, where he is also assistant clinical professor of medicine. BJ studied art history at Princeton. He completed medical school at UCSF and then did his fellowship in hospice and palliative medicine at Harvard Medical School, where he split his clinical duties between the Massachusetts General Hospital and the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute. Now, those are the resume details. What's really interesting about BJ is his focus on bringing humanity to the end-of-life experience, informed by his unique personal story. In his work, BJ connects art, spirituality, and medicine in end-of-life care. He has a grant from the Fetzer Foundation to help integrate spirituality with the health of mind and body into medical education. As executive director of Zen Hospice Project, BJ leads an organization that bridges spiritual and humanitarian approaches to end-of-life care. All of this was influenced by a serious accident that BJ suffered that brought him face-to-face with death at a very early age. His recent TED Talk on this topic, which was posted less than a week ago, already has received nearly 750,000 views. And as I've edited these remarks since last night, it keeps going up. I'm tempted to say much more about BJ, but I think that you would be better off hearing from him directly through our conversation. So please help me welcome Dr. BJ Miller. Hey, thank you. Welcome, BJ.
Thank you, Mark.
It's a pleasure to have you here at the Commonwealth Club.
It's fun to be here.
You are executive director of Zen Hospice Project. I have to admit that I don't regularly hear the words Zen and hospice in the same sentence. Okay? So what is the Zen Hospice Project, and what's unusual about it?
Well, you don't hear that often because there aren't that many places, not that many hospice houses in the first place, and not that many places that are explicitly spiritual in their bent. There's a lot to say about that. So one of the things that we love to do is integrate. You know, there's the subject's so huge. There's no one discipline that has a lock on how we die, or on how we suffer, or what feels good. So traditionally, in the system, you know, medical services and social services are split apart. Well, we kind of bring those together. We have a roof under which to bring those together, and we do so sort of underpinned or wrapped in a spiritual basis, a very inclusive and open one. But that's pretty novel. Another thing that's pretty novel about what we do is that really we're sort of an advocacy organization. almost activist, I might say. But you could really argue that the whole field of hospice and palliative care is inherently, it's sort of a revolutionary field in a lot of ways, and there's more to say about that. But we're blissfully part of that revolution.
And how is it revolutionary? What's different about it?
Well, I think a couple different ways to answer that. One is, you know, traditionally the healthcare system is designed around diseases. And any of us who have been a patient might have that experience. You feel like you are sort of incidental to your disease. You're processed, especially in a hospital setting. And you'll overhear staff talking about, you know, the heart in room number 4, or, you know, you're defined by your illness. So hospice and palliative care flips that around. We are blissfully subjective. The field goes right to the patient's experience. And you might say that we're part of this revolution from a disease-centric to a human-centric model of care.
Okay. Well, I've had the pleasure of visiting Zen Hospice Project, a beautiful Victorian house in San Francisco. And in my mind, the physical environment itself is unusual for a place where people go most often to die, frankly.
Yeah.
Why was it selected? Why did it was designed that way?
Well, a couple things. One is to point out before too much time goes by that we also, our volunteers staff Laguna Honda's hospital too, a big 30 or 60 bed now palliative care unit. So our volunteers are at our guest house as well as the county's safety net facility. That's an important detail about our organization. But there's something you point out about the beauty of the house. So first of all, it's a Victorian, which is very San Francisco. Right? I mean, death is a universal event, but it's extremely local in how you experience it and how it's handled. And there's something very apropos about a Victorian in San Francisco being our guest house. Mm-hmm. And as you pointed out, you'll know the difference right when you walk in the door. It is, you're not in a hospital. You're not in a nursing home. And you feel that almost immediately. And that is a very welcome experience. Most of the time, when patients come to us, they've been through the ringer. And you hear time and again, the moment they come to the door, there's just sort of a release.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of that's nothing to do with the people in the building. A lot of it is to do with the people in the building. But there's a lot of it, but just the building itself. It's just a beautiful place to be.
It is. One of the things that surprised me most during my visit was the kitchen. I had a chef there who really was cooking some beautiful food. What was surprising there is, of course, I know that most people who are near death don't want to eat much. Mm-hmm. So what's that about?
Yes, thank you for going there quickly. This is my favorite piece. There's a lot to say about this, too. I mean, so the senses, and we all know, is primal stuff. And, you know, I like to remind ourselves that the body, whatever else dies, our body definitely dies. We know that much. I think we could probably all agree. And the body is made up, but we experience life by sensing our way, right? So the sense of smell, taste, touch, all these things are important in our daily lives in all sorts of ways. And it's important to remember that dying people are still living. So it's a key. So the things which affect us as living people affect us while we're dying. And maybe even more so. So as we're losing our purpose, as we're losing our mobility, etc., very often you have something left. Maybe just a sense of smell. And so if you can't eat anything, the smell of cookies or bacon wafting through the house can be a really magical thing. No, a really magical thing. And one of the things I love about it is it's immediate. It's not a means to an end. I don't love the smell of cookies because if I eat those cookies, I'm going to... I love the smell of cookies because it just smells great now. And so when you're running out of time, there's something about tending to the senses which keeps you in the moment, which allows you to sort of play it all the way out, which is great. So our kitchen sort of symbolizes this. And there's also a symbolic plane to cooking. Well, there's cooking for the families and friends, but as you point out, a lot of our patients, our residents, can't eat. But there's this symbolism that food connotes. Mm-hmm. Someone cares for you. It implies nurturing, right? So there's something about the act of cooking and the ritual of cooking that extends a warmth and a welcome that we love, too.
Let's talk a bit about rituals, because it's hard to talk about spirituality without talking about rituals. Mm-hmm. You've got people from all walks of life coming to Zen Hospice Project. What rituals do you have there that they have in common?
So there are two major ones at the house. One is a bathing ritual. Ceremonial bathing. And by the way, we offer when our residents, we speak with our residents very early on in their stay with us to see if they want these rituals. I mean, one of the things that's very important is to constantly bring the care back into the context of that person, that patient, and what they want. Very often people elect these rituals. So one is the bathing ritual. And another, we're always looking for things that cut across culture so that may be welcomed no matter what your faith may be. And bathing is one of them. So there's a bathing ritual. And allows for a family and loved ones to say goodbye to that body in a particular way. And then the second one is the flower ritual, flower ceremony, which is a particular favorite for many of us there. I mean, so after the person dies, then their body, the mortuary comes and to retrieve the body. As we're wheeling the person out, we all pause in the garden for a moment. And we gather a bunch of flower petals and we gather around that body. And, you know, sometimes we'll just sit in silence. Sometimes family members will say something. Sometimes we'll sing a song. Staff, volunteers, our nurses, it's a moment to say goodbye and to share what that person meant to us. It's a moment for the administrative staff to gather around and partake too. And then we sprinkle the body with flower petals. And that's about it. And then the bag is zipped up and off the body goes. But that's a final image that for all of us is so much more welcoming and fun. Well, fun's the wrong word, but beautiful or warm to remember than is the typical dying experience in a hospital setting.
Mm-hmm. Now, I guess I wanted to ask, what's Zen about the Zen Hospice Project? Is everybody there a Buddhist? Who is it? Kenneth Rexroth said everybody in San Francisco is a Buddhist, but that's not really true. Are they all Buddhist, and do people ever say, I don't want those rituals?
Yes, some people say they don't want those rituals. Rarely, but sure, some people opt out.
But we're all still practicing.
Well, sure. And there's a lot of overlay between the practice of medicine, the practice of Buddhism. Practice is a key word because it implies it's not like you get it right and you're done. You're always working on it. You're always honing it. So you're never finished. But to answer your question, Mark, no, not everyone. I don't identify as Zen Buddhist myself. I don't know if that's shocking or not, but plenty of our staff and our volunteers do not. But Zen is unique. It would be different for me to try to run a Catholic organization if I weren't Catholic. There's something about Buddhism that is all-inclusive. It's inarguable, in a way. There's no faith demanded of anybody, per se. All right. So it is inherently a welcoming tradition. But it really sets us up with a technique around being with suffering, which is something that we doctors generally don't do very well. If we see a problem we can't fix, we start getting a little jittery. Whereas in the Buddhist tradition, in a place like Zen Hospice, we're actually quite practiced at sitting with things that we can't change. Mm-hmm. And that sets a very different tone. So you'll feel it, you'll feel a difference, but it won't necessarily strike you as a particular tradition.
Well, it strikes me as a non-expert in Zen that much of the central issues there are around being present, right? Mm-hmm. And certainly while people are near the end of their lives, being present is probably a lot better than being in the future, right? And it seems that many of the things you try to do for the senses and the rituals and so forth are to bring people to the present, to have them appreciate it more fully.
That's right. So this business about living fully until you die, I mean, that means many things. But it means staying in the moment as long as you possibly can, because that's all you really have. And I think that's irrefutable. But especially as we're losing our senses, as losing our mind, losing our thoughts, losing our purpose, this idea, the future, we have no purchase in the future, but we always do in the present until we're gone.
Mm-hmm.
So it's this way to stay with it, stay here until the end. So that part of that's a meditative stance, and part of it's appealing to the senses and the immediacy of the senses. And part of it's just an organization that's hell-bent on carving out space for now.
Mm-hmm.
Also really potent for us in the healthcare professions because, you go through hospital training and everything. It's constantly this delayed gratification. Well, I'm going to go through my residency. It's going to be hell. But and on the end of residency, then I'll be there. And then you're just on this constantly delaying, deferring. And before you know it, because you can't plan, right, you might die. And you may have delayed your gratification till beyond that death moment, which is a huge shame.
Yeah. Now, as nice as Zen Hospice Project is, don't most patients want to die at home? Why would they want to come to the Zen Hospice Project?
Yeah. So, for starters, I mean, there's nothing about our organization or me in particular that, I mean, we are absolutely here to support people wherever they want to die. And that's often at home. But I also think that it's sort of a old trope. Everyone wants to die at home, no one can. But in our experience, a lot of people who would have in the abstract checked that box, yes, I want to die at home, actually when it comes down to it, can't or don't want to. It's very common that people come to be with us after being on home hospice. So by that point, you know, families may be burning out. If you have a family, you know, your friends may need to go back to work, whatever it is. And in general, we are dying in a protracted, increasingly complicated way. So this idea of holding vigil as a family for a week or two is one thing, but months or even years with multiple chronic illnesses, that gets very difficult. So in the abstract, sure, let's all die at home. That sounds great. But it's not likely possible for many of us. Mm-hmm. So right now, your options are head back to the ER, which few of us want to do, or go to a nursing home, which in general few of us want to do. But that's where the third piece of what's novel about us is this fleshing out this continuum of care by providing this link in the chain, this place to be, this place to live.
And of course, you may want to bring elements of your home with you. What are the policies about people visiting friends or family?
Oh, it's, you know, we try to maintain some visiting hours. It's tight quarters, but for the most part, every time we set a rule, we break or bend it or break it almost immediately. We should just get used to that. But yeah, I mean, it's a place by virtue of our licensing structure, it is not particularly forbidding, right? So people can bring their dogs or cats to some. At some point, I think we've had one or two cats, maybe a bird or two. But family members sleeping in the bed with the resident or on the chair, it does make us long for more space. It's tight quarters. And that's the only thing that limits what people can bring into the house, is just there's a lack of space.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, I have heard the rumor that although your title is executive director, the one who really rules the roost is your dog.
Yeah, Maisie, my dog. Yeah, I'll just quickly say Maisie's great. Some of you guys know her. She's a beautiful animal, but she's half pit bull, half German shepherd, and she's like the worst hospice dog in the world because there's not, you know, people want the golden retriever who's going to come up and lick their face, and she's like, she could care less. But anyway, she's a pretty good mascot.
Well, BJ, I mentioned earlier that you had a serious accident earlier in your life, and I know you're very open in talking about it and that it is really essential to who you are both as a doctor and a person. So I'd like you to share that story and also how it's influenced your career.
Sure. So sophomore year, Princeton University, just screwing around one night after Thanksgiving holiday. We just got back, and friends of mine and I were out on the town. We thought there's a park train sitting there. Climb it like you climb a jungle gym. I just happened to be the first up, and I had a metal watch on. I got close enough to the power line and the electricity arc to the watch, and that was it. Big a life changer. I was in the burn unit for a couple months. But it also brought a lot of my family and friends together, many of whom are in the audience right now, including Brother Tommy Pinckney and the Chandler sisters and all sorts of people who helped me live. And it was in that experience that, first of all, I got to experience a healthcare system. And by the way, I should say, I had incredible care. You know, healthcare is sort of a pinata these days. But there's also some beautiful things that happen within healthcare. So I got great care. It introduced me to the system in a lot of ways. But mostly introduced me to the idea, what I like to call the myth of independence, the truth of interdependence, and how much I relied on my friends and family to get me through it all, to give me purpose, to give me a reason to keep going. It was gorgeous. And I learned a ton. And now I get to sort of reverse that role a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And I must say, it's a lot of, I feel like I get, I feel like I have a sort of a cheap shortcut, because I'm obviously disabled, and I'm grateful for that in a lot of ways. Because my patients, I see them, and within a second, they know I've been in the bed. And that gets me to places with folks pretty quickly. So my earning their trust is a different path for me, and I'm very grateful for that.
Mm-hmm. And talk to me about how that influenced your decision to go into medicine, and specifically palliative care medicine.
So going into medicine, it was sort of a way to make sense of this weird experience. That was it in a nutshell. So I thought, I'll go and do rehab medicine, work with other amputees. That seemed like the most direct way. But it turns out just trying to make sense of my life wasn't quite enough. I had to actually enjoy the work. So I had made this promise myself, because, you know, when you get close to death, a common response is, wow, okay, if I make it through this, I'm going to live my life a little differently. I'm going to enjoy it while I have it. You become very sort of viscerally aware that it ends someday. And so similarly, again, this idea of going into healthcare, all this delayed gratification, et cetera, I promised myself that if I hated it, I'd stop. Or if I found something else I'd rather do, I'd do that. I didn't want it to be the sacrificial pursuit. Mm-hmm. So deep in a medical school, I did a rotation in rehab medicine and actually realized I just, for a number of reasons, did not like it. So I dropped out of what's called the match when you're applying for residencies, and I was going to go do something else. My dean talked me into doing my internship here, Dean Maxine Papadakis at UCSF. Said, you know, okay, graduate, obviously, and do 1 year of your residency, because then at least you can get your license to practice. It's easier to jump back in. You can prescribe your friends drugs, whatever. So it was good. It seemed like a good idea. I said, okay. But my sister had just died. Mm-hmm. And so my family was now at this point in Milwaukee. So I said, okay. I'll go back to Milwaukee, live with mom and dad, do my internship, and then we'll get out of this thing. It was during my internship that I did a rotation in palliative medicine and fell head over heels pretty instantaneously. So I know that's a long-winded answer to your question, Mark. But,
that's how you got there. Okay, good. Well, you talked about a lot of people helping you. I think that one of the most remarkable things about Zen Hospice Project is you have, close to 200 volunteers? And these aren't just sort of candy stripers who walk in the door. They have to go through a pretty extensive training program, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Look at you, Bob.
Yeah, talk about that.
There are a number of our volunteers in the audience. The volunteer program is bedrock for Zen Hospice Project. And it is for some of the older hospice organizations in general. By the time hospice made its way across the pond, it was a social movement in the 70s and 80s here. And Zen Hospice is cut from that same cloth, a sort of countercultural, non-medical social movement. And Zen Hospice is very much of that ilk. So our volunteer pool is not quite 200. I'm not sure what it is, 100-ish. But it's profound. It's deep. A lot of our volunteers stay with us for a long time. And so besides a sort of free labor piece, there is much more importantly, because it ain't free, but more importantly, of course, is that the volunteers represent the sort of human element. I mean, I can come with my bag of tricks as a doctor. I could be a jerk, but if I'm really good at pain medicine, I'll still be in the room. Volunteers, they set a tone of, no, this is a human-to-human thing, and I am here to be with you. You know, as a physician, a lot of my role is to do stuff. But as a human being, bearing witness, sitting there, being present, that's the job of the volunteer. That's all of our jobs, but that's what our volunteers particularly symbolize, and it's a great potency.
Mm-hmm. You must offer something to the volunteers. It's not money. What do they get out of it?
Well, you'd have to ask one of the volunteers to get a true question. Now, I bet you'd get a lot of different answers to that question. I mean, I think some of us, you know, to become a Zen Hospice volunteer, you have to have some spiritual practice. It doesn't have to be anything in particular. It can be a yoga practice. It can be whatever. But our volunteers are explicitly there to think about their own mortality and practice the act of service. And one of the things, a great potency of Zen Hospice Project is, you know, the culture of healthcare is a little of a, it's sort of sacrificial, like we've talked about a little bit already. It's pathological altruism. You want to show you care, you know, don't go to sleep for 3 days. You know, you want to show you care as a doctor, you know, have no personal life. That's the currency. That's crazy. It doesn't really work. So something about our training, there's something about offering up this experience that by we somehow link the act of caregiving and care receiving, which sets up this very sweet reciprocity, so that if you see yourself in your patient, by treating that patient, you are treating yourself. And we explicitly shine a light on that sort of phenomenon, which tends to... So people who volunteer with us are fed by the experience, not depleted by the experience. Mm-hmm. And I think healthcare has a lot to learn by that basic math.
Great. Now you do a lot of training with them. Do you also have training programs or anything for the informal caregivers, for the family or friends?
Yes, we do. Increasingly, we're working on it. We have a few called mindful caregiver training programs, which is sort of various sort of expurgated versions of the volunteer caregiving training that we have. So 1 day and 2 day trainings, and we're just getting started on those. So please, if you're interested, check that out on our website. We want to build that that program. So to do, you know, to come do a 1 or 2 day training with us, you don't have to sign up for a year of practice with us. You can go back home. You can pay that forward in your own professional work or whatever else. But a lot of the people who come into that training are just family members who have a sick person at home or who are just interested in learning the art of giving care.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. How do people pay for Zen Hospice?
That's tricky. Yeah, that's an important question. I'm not sure many of you guys might not know, but hospice as an insurance benefit, it's a wonderful thing. It has some holes in it, it has some problems, and we're working that out on the policy level, but it does not cover residential care. So we do not have any access. There's one of the reasons why a guest house like ours is so rare is that it's a crazy business to go into. You have to be kind of nuts to go into this business. There are no revenue streams built into it. So we do ask the families to pay what they can, and then we raise the rest of the money. We have a robust development team who makes that happen. There's another point there too, though. Half of our beds at the guest house, at least, are in partnership with UCSF, with their medical center. In a stroke of a really enlightened moment, one of our board members and a woman I love very much and worked with in the halls of UCSF, Jane Hawgood, had the foresight to approach the medical center and sort of work out a relationship when the guest house was reopening. Bottom line is the UCSF pays a cost on half of those beds and reserves those for their patients. That offers a place for them to get out of the hospital. And the way that works financially is complicated. We can go into it if you'd like. But the bottom line is that ultimately saves UCSF a lot of money. So it's a financially savvy partnership, but it's also savvy on the quality side of things too. So on those three beds, while we still ask the patient to pay what they can to contribute, and that goes back to UCSF, if they can pay $1 a month, that's fine. So that's fully half of our beds. And then also it's worth calling out one of our actually the very first donor to Zen Hospice, a woman named Marion Weber, a beautiful woman in Stinson Beach. She started a fund that essentially covers the cost on one of the beds. Mm-hmm. So on four of our six beds at the guest house, we're essentially means blind. Mm-hmm. Which is amazing and really important, because one of the charms of death and dying is we all go there, rich, poor. We don't want to set up rich people, you die over here, poor people, you die over there. That would be a shame. So thanks to UCSF and Marion, we don't have to do that.
And for the UCSF beds, do they have to be Medicare patients?
Nope.
Not necessarily. Okay. How many people are private pay?
So everyone is paying something.
Yeah.
Everyone's paying something. The other two beds are, if two patients come to us at the same time with everything else being the same, one of them can pay more than the other, we do have to take that into account. Mm-hmm. I have to say, I'll be honest, but that's for two of our six beds.
How about long-term care insurance policies? Would they work for them?
Yeah, thank you. I was just about to say that. So long-term care policies will pay, some policies will cover some of the cost, mm-hmm. rarely all of the cost. Mm-hmm. But it's worth noting, it's rare, it's really worth saying, because few people have long-term care insurance, but those who do, it's a great place to leverage it.
Cool. So what I'm not clear on is, to what degree does the Medicare hospice benefit pay any of your revenues? Zero.
Zilch.
Zero.
I'm sorry, I hear myself talking a lot here. So insurance at this point pays $0, except for long-term care insurance. Health insurance per se pays zero of what we do. Mm-hmm. And it's not just Zen Hospice, it's any residential hospice, whether it's George Mark Children's House or whether it's Coming Home Hospice or you name it, Sarah House, or the number of places like ours in the state. But insurance at this point does not cover any of that burden.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
One more thing to note. Health Net, in this changing landscape, one of the things that we offer, so if we move from a fee-for-service model to a value-based model, mm-hmm. a place like Zen Hospice all of a sudden becomes way more relevant. So in part, we were introduced to the folks at Health Net who signed up to say, in a novel way, first time ever, said, we'll cover a one-month stay with you guys. And that was about a year and a half ago. But we saw one Health Net patient in this time who lived for about 12 hours by the time they got to our house. Mm-hmm. So it's worth noting that exists. But the soffits and connections and all the sort of nitty-gritty that make that thing function or not, get people and the case managers on their computers to think about Zen Hospice, which doesn't come up on their screen, et cetera, that work has still to be done.
Okay. I know you spend part of your time in medical education, and have a grant on this and so forth. So as you well know, there are some proposals that Medicare has right now to pay doctors to have end-of-life conversations. This came up years ago. Sarah Palin kind of knocked it down with the death panels. Now we have new proposals. Yeah. I think it's being commented on right now. So I'm curious as to whether you think if those proposals were to pass, what impact would that have, and particularly how well trained are doctors, how well equipped are they to have those conversations if they're not specifically boarded in palliative care, for example?
Mm. Yeah, yeah. So
it's in a very important moment because, so you guys remember the death panel charade. And it sort of just sunk the conversation for years. No one would politically touch it at the federal level. Darn it. But now there's we're revisiting that, thankfully. So I would say it's symbolically very important that the feds and that Medicare are looking at this piece of the puzzle. Because advanced care planning is a bit of a Trojan horse for placing that power in the patient's hands. That's its real potency as far as I'm concerned. You know, how much the benefit in real terms, I'm not sure how much else will come of it. We'll see. Mm-hmm. But it's symbolically really important and heralds a real shift in thinking. But to the rest of your question, Mark, you know, few physicians are comfortable having this conversation, really, even if they're paid to do so or have the time to do so. It's a really difficult conversation to have well. And it calls out the need for the specialty of palliative care, where we are actually trained to have this conversation. Still, it's on the whole a very good thing. Again, back to soffits and connections and things. Many of you in the room might have stories of, you know, people who did all their homework, did their advanced care planning, never mind the doc being paid for it, but living will, pulsed form, did all that work, and still, by the time that person got into an ambulance into a hospital, that advanced directive somehow got entirely lost, and the care went against their wishes. That happens too frequently. So that calls out the need from a design point of view for communications, for electronic medical records to function in a different way, et cetera. So just by virtue of, you're not done once you do your advanced directive. Okay, there's more work to be done to making sure that that directive is adhered to.
Okay.
But this is a start.
Mm-hmm. It's time right now for me to remind everybody that you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Mark Zitter, CEO of Zitter Health Insights, and I'm speaking with Dr. B.J. Miller, Executive Director of Zen Hospice Project. I'm curious as to how your working at Zen Hospice Project has influenced the way that you think you'd like to spend your own final days.
Mm. Oh, I'm not going to die.
Good. Optional.
Right on.
I would say I'm one of those, maybe I'm a little unusual. I think there's I kind of imagine dying alone. And I don't mean that in some depressive way. I just have always kind of pictured that. But more than being alone, I kind of always pictured, there's a kind of going back to Mother Nature. There's a feeling of, if you ask me, the immortality exists on sort of this natural level. Let me decompose. Let me get back into the ground. So I always sort of figured I'd want to feel soil and see the sky. You know, that's where I'd like to be. Now, it's very hard to orchestrate that. extremely hard. But working at Zen Hospice has turned me on to the idea of actually daring to be surrounded by strangers. And that might be just really wonderful. Can you imagine new friends in the final moments of life? And that's a pretty cool thing.
Yeah. Now, you're doing some wonderful groundbreaking things at Zen Hospice Project. But 2.5 million people die every year in America. You've got 6 beds. So how can, I know that you have a vision for more. How can you leverage that vision from only your 6 beds to influence the way that people end their lives in America or die in America?
Well, yeah, it's a good point. So a couple things. One is by virtue of working on the education front, there's so many things that have to happen. There's a policy piece here. There's a workforce piece here. There's a systems piece, okay? All need to be happening, right? You can't, frankly, in the field, we're afraid to stoke the demand for palliative care on some level, because if everyone who needs palliative care said finally got hip to what it was and said, hey, I want palliative care, damn it, we could never meet the current need. The system would implode. So there's a little tension of stoking the demand while the supply ain't there. Okay, but so putting that aside for a second, as an organization, we, as part of this move towards sort of really changing the culture, we want to participate in this workforce education. So our mindful caregiver training, our volunteer training, our work at UCSF, we have an interprofessional class. So that's really exciting work for us, and we'd like to figure out a way to get that education to more people. So that's one way that we're going to change things. Another is this advocacy piece. You know, we were part of forming the San Francisco Palliative Care Task Force, first such thing. The Department of Public Health created about a year ago. 30 organizations got around a table to start thinking about how this society was going to, how we were going to die. That was novel. That is novel. It's really exciting. So that's happening, and we were a force for helping make that happen. So we're working on those other planes. I stay active as a clinician at UCSF to see patients there. But to your point about the facility, the residential care, that's really, really key. And it's we think of the guest house, those six beds, as something of a laboratory, sort of this innovation hub. Let us work the kinks out there. You know, I'd love to build a place that's big enough to serve the whole of the Bay Area. That would be thrilling. Mm-hmm. Build multiple places, but at this point, that would be very shaky to do right like tomorrow because it would be very hard to sustain it for all the reasons we just said. Mm-hmm. So we got to work on these multiple planes. But I think the biggest answer to your question is really seeing the guest house as this hub of innovation where we try things, where we try to get the model right before we ever attempt anything like scale.
Mm-hmm. Well, speaking of innovation, one of the most surprising things, I think, if someone visits your website, is you say that Zen Hospice Project has a partnership with IDEO. Mm-hmm. IDEO, of course, is probably the best-known firm in the country doing innovative design. You think about them doing iPhones and things like that. So tell us about that partnership and how that might affect the way we think about dying in America.
Yeah, it's really fun. I mean, those guys, we have a friendship, frankly. And we've worked with them professionally in a couple of things on our website, getting ready for that TED craziness. And, you know, right now we're talking to them about sort of how do we structure Zen Hospice to sort of have the best effect, et cetera. But more than exchange really is our friendship, where we just sort of feed off each other. The design world, I mean, look, we have, just think about dying. Everyone does it. There are variables that go into dying well that are known. Right there, you have design cues. You have a design, you know, fantasy land. You know, I don't know, maybe Diane, I don't know which of us said it first, but this idea of dying is 100% market penetrance, you know? it's dreamy as a subject if you're trying to. It's huge. And the low, pathetically low bar also is very tantalizing, right? And at the time where policy, there's an attitude and an aptitude to reimagine policy. And at the same time, you have 76 million baby boomers. I mean, so all this confluence of events, you know, design has huge relevance because that's, you know, dying is an experience. And as such, a largely known experience. So it's not difficult to bring design into that mix, design thinking to that mix, and especially IDEO. I mean, these are the kings of human-centered design, right? Sounds a lot like patient-centered care.
Mm-hmm.
So bringing this stuff together is really kind of thrilling. Where that's all going to go, I don't know. We'll see.
Well, you mentioned the term dying well. Some people would think of the phrase good death as an oxymoron, but I don't think you think that's true. What is a good death?
Well, first of all, it ain't for me to say what a good death for you is. You know, for one, is this is a highly subjective, and we in the field delight in that fact. The rest of medicine pretends to be objective. We laugh. So, you know, so it's up for each of us to say. But I would say this phrase, dying well, is really important. And that is the title of a book by Ira Byock, which I highly recommend to all you guys. And it's a little bit of wordplay. Because, okay, you can die a whole person. You can die having, you can be healed and still die. There's something about the idea, the frame of being well, is being right with the facts of your life. And the facts of your life is I'm dying soon. You don't have to be, it's not a broken phenomenon inherently. So dying well means a couple of different things, and all of which are irrelevant here. If you ask me, I think I've come to see, you know, I think of us as in the field as we're sort of ushers and we are advocates. So my job in palliative care is to figure out to help inform my patients, you know, make sure that they've got the right stuff to think about. And then mostly my job is to listen to them and to hear what they want, what their goals are. And then my job is really to link their goals with what's possible in the system. That's my job, not to mandate any particular way of dying. One of the things that's very exciting for us in the field, there's a propensity for us in the field to think that a good death means a DNR order, you know, not being in an ICU. But actually, you know, some people want to be in an ICU. It's a really thrilling moment for us to get a palliative care consult when the team might says, "Hey, will you go get the DNR? You know, will you go get that? Will you go convince that person that intubation's not going to help them, mm-hmm. et cetera?" And you go back and you talk to that person. You say, "You know, it's not going to help you." You know, they say, "Well, you know what? I want to go down swinging. It's important to me. This is how I've always seen myself. This is how my family sees me. Damn it, this is the way I want to go out." Okay. My job is to help them get that death, mm-hmm. even though it's not the one I would want. So, mm-hmm. you know, the enemy of good palliative care is projection. Mm-hmm. You know, we got to really watch ourselves that way.
Okay. Question from the audience. In your experience, does a person's spiritual practice have a significant influence on their quality of life as they approach the end?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, so, you know, I think spirituality is a weird, I get uncomfortable, frankly. I have been uncomfortable with that word because I don't know what the heck it means. So we, it's in hospice, trying to get united internally, even at the board level, went through this fun little exercise. It's like, okay, let's define spirituality for ourselves. What do we mean at Zen Hospice when we use it? Well, so we said, all right, we see impermanence as a fact, as just part of the deal, mm-hmm. right? And we respond to that impermanence with cultivation of presence, being in the moment. We respond by heralding and delighting in interdependence. And most tellingly, my favorite is this piece, that we hold space for all that we don't know. That really is super key. Science has a way of trying to reduce us, you know, a drive for knowledge. Right? The difference between the smartest and the dumbest of us is actually on the spectrum of all there is to know. It's not that much, right? So holding, not alienating all the things that we don't know, but actually revering them, holding space for the things we don't know, to me, that gets at spirituality. That's mm-hmm. a very beautiful thing. Now, so that's sort of an internal answer to your question. But we also know from data from the California Healthcare Foundation that spirituality happens to be very important to Californians. It's like number three on the list, the top three issues that are concerning to people who die in this state. Okay, so however you define spirituality, we know it's important to people. And it's particularly important because it gets at how people make meaning of their lives and how they make meaning of their death. This existential anxiety, existential suffering is one of the areas where we really struggle in healthcare. We don't know what to do with that.
Mm-hmm.
But spirituality mm-hmm. has a lot to do with that.
We have a question that's got a couple of elements to it. Here, I'll read it for you. Since more often than not, the most resistant person around supporting the transition to hospice ends up being the closest loved one, to what degree do you use the power of music and arts-inspired resources to remind the loved ones of the power of embracing and accepting the importance of facing and accepting the inevitable end of life? There's a lot to that question.
Yeah. So this is a person. As you mentioned, I'm an art history major. Uh-huh. I'm not a science guy so much. I just don't have a great aptitude for it, mm-hmm. And I respect all that goes into medical science. But one of the joys for me is this field of palliative care has this really mildly subversive way to upload all the humanities into healthcare.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, number one on that list are the arts. Just personal joy and what they've meant to me, trying to make sense of my life and after my injuries, et cetera. And how is it that we're not our bodies? What are we then? And why the hell do we make art as human beings? What is that impulse? You know, it's just a fascinating, beautiful subject. So the arts, as a mouthpiece, can say things that our normal prose can't get to, the sort of ineffable stuff. They can create a sort of ambient environment, a set a certain stage for things to happen, which is a beautiful thing. And they can reward you for paying attention. So we in the body, in the public, right? you know, traditionally in the city, if you can tell what that society cares most about. Look at the buildings that get their energy. Look at the artwork that gets their energy. So I would love to see where society starts, where public art starts touching on this subject. I think there's a lot for us. This basic math of rewarding paying attention is a really cool stuff. But I don't think that answers the question. I just realized.
Not completely. Yeah. How do you use, for example, music intentionally at Zen Hospice Project?
Well, so there's a field of music thanatology. There's a discipline to playing music to help usher people into the next zone, whatever that is. A way to help people let go. I mean, I think we all probably have a music as a... there's a certain effect of music that I'm sure we all have a very personal relationship with it. So do know that there is a field around this, and there's some serious attention that goes into it, and we have a lot of volunteers who come to the guest house and play music at the guest house, and it does all those things that we just described. It's a very beautiful thing. But of course, also in the residence, they bring their own music. You know, it's also part of them revealing their personality, you know, expressing themselves. And that's also very beautiful.
On a practical question, someone says, how can a person who is dying apply for admission to Zen Hospice Project? There must be a very long wait list.
So, well, go to our website. Sounds like a plug. But really, you know, zenhospice.org is where you download the application. And we just finally got, we used to have to print it out and blah, blah, blah. Now you can fill it out online. So that was a big move for us. I don't mean that cynically. I mean, it was actually a big move for us. It took us a while to figure that out. So you fill out an application, and then at that point you'd speak with Jolene, our wonderful director of nursing, and then you'd have also a conversation around the financial piece, and then you're in line. Mm-hmm. And yeah, we often do have a waiting list, but you know what's funny, especially at the six beds, we'll be full for months, and it's true at Zen Hospice and other places and other hospice organizations. People perk up. You know, you may be on death's door. Then you go into hospice, and all of a sudden you start living again. It's really remarkable. Why? Because it's back on your terms, and you're surrounded by people who love you instead of strangers who smell funny. You know, and it's a totally different experience. Mm-hmm. So what often happens is we'll be full with a waiting list, and then no one dies for a while, and then that wait list, people die on the waiting list, and then all of a sudden everyone dies in the house, and then we'll be half empty. So it's really part of the struggle for us at the end of six beds, it's tricky.
Well, there's a related question here about, are there plans to open up more beds or more facilities? And if not, how can people help that happen?
I mean, we'd love to. Mm-hmm. It's a pet interest of mine for all this design and the architecture piece like we talked about. But there's a real need for these beds, too. I mean, there are other organizations, right? Maitri does really great residential care in the city, but HIV, largely HIV-specific. Coming Home Hospice does beautiful work, all right? Similar place as ours. George Mark in the East Bay for Children, beautiful work there. And that's actually a lot versus other cities in this country and in the state. We have a lot of such beds, but we still don't have enough. Mm-hmm. So as we were talking about earlier, the struggles would be to build that place, would be how to sustain it without revenue sources, et cetera, figured out. But we're working on that. But one of the things, if you know anyone's interested, one of the things we'd love to fund would be a real feasibility study on, okay, really, let's get serious. How many beds does this city need? What's it going to take? Where could we build such a place? We'd really love to do that. So if anyone's interested, come find us. And I'm sorry, you're right. Laguna Honda, it can't be said enough. Laguna Honda is traditionally, you know, a safety net facility. You picture a place you'd never want to be. But I got to tell you, some beautiful things happen at Laguna Honda. It's an amazing place, especially their hospice and palliative care ward. And in part, at least, thanks to the Zen Hospice volunteers who've been staffing it for over 20 years. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of beautiful things and a lot of dying well happens at Laguna Honda, too. Thanks very much. Mm-hmm. Ask the moderator.
Jay, typically for hospice payment, for certification for hospice reimbursement, a physician has to declare that a patient has no more than 6 months to live.
Yeah.
Is that irrelevant at Zen Hospice, given that you don't get that kind of reimbursement anyway? Or is it relevant?
It is and it isn't. So one of the joys of being outside the healthcare system is, you know, we have a lot of freedom in a way. So there's nothing in our licensure that would say you have to be within 6 months, that you have to die within 6 months to be there. But practically speaking, we really rely on our partners in the home hospice industry, the home hospice agencies, Hospice by the Bay, Kaiser, Pathways, Sutter. These guys are the ones who follow the patients into our house. They're almost always on the home hospice benefit, but we become their home. So we really rely on that shared collaborative work with the home hospice agencies. They're the ones who bring the medications in. They hold the medical care plan, et cetera. So practically speaking, we really do need folks who come to be with us at the guest house really do need to be on the hospice benefit. We blissfully look for exceptions to that rule. There's so much cool work that can be done for respite, a short stay to come with us. And that can be done on hospice too. But even upstream of that, patients burning out for whatever, or families burning out for whatever reason, we'd be a great place to come for a week, get your symptoms under control, let the family rest, and then go back home. We would love to do that kind of work. There's nothing in our license would prevent us to do that work, but practically speaking, we really rely on the home hospice agencies in a way that makes that, at this point, kind of untenable.
And how often do residents leave Zen Hospice alive?
You know, it's such a fun dilemma. It happens. It happens. I don't know how frequently. It's an exception, but it does happen. And it's not just at our place. I mean, people graduate off the hospice benefit at home often enough. Again, because very often when you stop the sort of aggressive medical care, you feel better. You know, you're spending more time with people you care about, doing things you care about than in a waiting room somewhere. And you know what? This idea that quality of life and quantity of life are somehow opposed, totally the opposite. We now understand very well, and increasingly so, the data points. You want to live long? Well, live well. Those things go together. You know, the hospice benefit is designed as a sort of fork in the road. You can go on to hospice and have quality of life, but you got to give up on the other thing. That's not true. It actually doesn't play out that way. You want to live long? Live well.
Yeah. Yeah, and I know that explicitly there's 3 or 4 studies showing that people who go off chemotherapy versus those who are on chemotherapy at the end of life for certain cancers actually live longer going towards hospice. So better quality of life, better, longer life. You know, this seems like an intelligence test. Like, why wouldn't you choose that?
Right. Amen, brother.
Question about you personally and how you handle the grief of constantly being around people who are declining and ultimately dying.
You know, there's a lot of burnout is a real issue in the field of palliative care. It's true, on the par with oncology. Mm-hmm. You got to keep up with all the losses. Mm-hmm. You know, to do the work well, you really have to empathize with your patients. And if you're empathizing with your patients, you're feeling what they're going through. And if you're feeling what your patients are going through, and you have 30 patients a day, you're feeling pretty lousy much of your day. Mm-hmm. That's undeniably true. There are ways to stay with it. One of my favorite people and patients is in the front row here, Frank, who's taught me a lot about keeping up with grief. There's a way to process so you can keep up with the losses, right? And so you can stay on the upside of that sort of razor's edge. But it is true enough that burnout is a real problem in the field, and I'm not immune to it. Mm-hmm. When I moved back to the Bay Area, I moved to Marin. I moved to Mill Valley to live on Mount Tam. So when I go home, I'm in the trees. Mm-hmm. And there's something about, I couldn't kill a plant in my yard if I tried to. There's something, just life just bounding out of the, and there's something, it's a really nice countervailing force in that for me. And each of us has our own way. Meredith, a colleague of mine, I'm sure has her own way with her family. You know, you talk to any palliative care provider and they're going to give you a different story. But for me, it's Mother Nature. It's time alone. It's time on my bike. It's time with my dog. It's time with my cats. Mm-hmm. Time with my friends.
What's the toughest part of your job?
The toughest part of my job, that's actually an easy question. You know, toughest part of my job is I'm sorry, I'm poaching my TED talk, but the unnecessary suffering, the gratuitous suffering, the logistical suffering. You know, my favorite analogy is, you know, if someone, you know, a tornado hits my house, I lose my house to a tornado, to Mother Nature, okay, I'll be sad. But if someone burns my house down willfully, I'm going to be sad plus angry, plus all sorts of other things, right? So What gets me is not that we die or that we suffer. I have come to see that as just completely normal. What gets me is how we heap it on. Even well-intended as a system, the healthcare system, we add to the suffering very often. We don't take it away. And that's not an evil comment about evil intention. Actually, healthcare generally means very well. It's just not designed very well. So my answer to your question is the sort of man-made elements of suffering. That's to witness it, to even be part of that, is the hardest part of the job.
Mm-hmm. Now, my understanding is you deal mostly with adults. There's a question from the audience about the provision of end-of-life and palliative care for children, a population that's been largely ignored in this regard. Mm-hmm. Do you do any work with children? What would you comment about that?
So I don't. We don't. Our license, you have to be 18 or older. Mm-hmm. And we have folks who are young. We've had residents who come and live and die with us in their 20s. But pediatrics is its own field. Pediatric palliative care is its own field. And this is where I've become extremely grateful for the existence of George Mark Children's House in San Leandro. A remarkable place and sort of a one of a kind. So all I can say is I don't tend to children myself. I'm not a pediatrician. Our house doesn't allow it, blah, blah, blah. The license doesn't allow it. But this is where we're so grateful to have friends who do that kind of work. Mm-hmm. So, and the field of palliative care is also growing rapidly. And you'd witness it at Children's Hospital in Oakland, at UCSF. So that field is also coming into its own as well.
Right. Here's a brief kind of enigmatic question, but I'll see if you want to answer it. What should one's last words be?
I don't know. What's that, Frank? Frank said, either the wallpaper goes or I do. It's his last final words. But that actually reminds me, for all the aesthetic piece, the architecture, the design piece, what beauty means to us viscerally. You know, Michael Graves, famous architect, had a horrible accident, found himself in a hospital. I can't remember his exact quote. He was like, I'm not dying now because this place is too damn ugly to die in. There's no way I'm dying here. Last words, I don't know. In my sense, I would imagine it's going to be some sort of a grunt because words, don't get me started on this one, but words have their limitations. I'm mostly interested in the stuff that words can't get to. That's what I'm in for. So I'll probably make some weird, visceral, grunty sound.
Well, we entitled this program Reimagining End of Life, so I want to ask you before we close, what are your hopes for the way that Americans will reimagine the end of life? Mm.
So I think my answer to that one is, my great hope for myself, for our organization, for our friends in this business, is that we kind of collectively move towards a society or where communities take pride in how they die. That as a community, it would judge itself by how well it tends to those who are suffering and dying. Mm-hmm. That would be like, then I could die. Then I could die. Yeah, that would be good.
Wonderful. We just have time for one or two more quick questions, but this one resonated with me, partly because I'm not a particularly spiritual person. I wish I were more so. Mm. But hands down, one of the most spiritual experiences I've had was when my dad died. And I think it's amazing how death makes us think so much about life. And this question is about, given that going through the end of someone else's life, helping them support them, often makes us deeply grateful for knowing them, for life itself. Mm. How can we use that sort of enhanced spirituality that most of us feel, no matter how spiritual we are on a day-to-day basis, we are more so when we're around that. How can we use that to sort of crack the code and cultivate more, a higher emotional and spiritual IQ?
For me, I think it comes down to coming to terms with us as relational and relative beings. You know, I just can't get away from the reason, one of the reasons why I get so much joy out of my life is because I've felt so much pain. I just can't get away from that basic math. And I've stopped trying. It used to bother me. I used to want to like head towards some absolute. You know, not anymore. And what makes anything precious but that it ends? You know, I love this question. So how many here, if you could push a button and live forever, who would push that button? And George, one of our staff, our beloved George Keller, who's the one guy who would push that. But my point is, look, very few of us would. What does that tell us? You know, the TED Talk was originally titled, they changed it. It was called Not Whether, But How. When it comes down to it, most of ourselves are worried about when and how we're going to die, not that we're going to die. In fact, we don't really want to live forever. So there's something about death that really actually brings a lot. It creates meaning. I don't think meaning would have much meaning if things just went forever. Mm-hmm. So I guess my answer to the question is coming to terms with that relative nature of things and the foil, the backdrop that beauty provides to make our decisions, bring value to our decisions, bring value to our choices, to our opinions, and let beauty sort of pop. It's a foil.
Wonderful. My last question for you. If you had one wish for how we live at the end of our lives, what would that be?
Let's see. I would just like to see us, I would like to see us play it all the way out. I would like to see us, I learned a lot from one of my, from my beloved dog, Vermont, who died of cancer. And I just watched him as an animal. You know, he just live. I mean, he kept dealing with whatever he was losing. He just kept going until he couldn't. You know, whether it was a choice or just by virtue of his body giving out, I would like to see us live sort of all the way out. Not this notion of, and this idea of aging and dying is sort of, I like to say, a crescendo, that we keep developing all the way to the end. That's what I kind of really am in for. Rather than the norm right now, which is sort of we're judged by our productivity. It's like, okay, you peak in your whatever, 40s or 50s, and then it's a process of just getting out of the way. So boring and dumb. So anyway, that's my answer.
Well, I must say that, Peter, you and the Zen Hospice Project are doing some very exciting, worthwhile work. By the way, I'm sure that BJ and his colleagues would be happy to have you visit their website. They're a not-for-profit organization. You can learn more. You can apply to be a volunteer. You can support them financially to spread the word. But right now, unfortunately, we are out of words, so I'd like to thank Dr. BJ Miller for his comments, thank our audiences here. Hold on. Thank you. I do have to say that we also thank our audience here and those listening to the recording. I'm Mark Zitter, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, commemorating its 113th year of enlightened discussion, is adjourned. There we go.
Thanks, Mark.
Thank you. Very well done. Very well done.